वसुदेव सुदेवं कंसचानूरमर्दनं देवकी परमानंदं कृष्णं वंदे जगद्गुरु। To continue the story concerning the Bhagavad Gita, we saw how the two clans, the two cousins, decided upon a fight, a battle. And when justice is jeopardized and all other alternatives have been found ineffective, then to use some sort of force becomes necessary. Thank you. To use some sort of force becomes necessary. Only that much can be said. What form this force takes has to be determined from time to time, taking into account all the elements involved. As for instance, in the modern technological world, to use aerial bombardment is totally immoral, where you kill people indiscriminately. You don't know who is good, who is bad, who is guilty and who is not guilty. Indiscriminately killing a whole lot of people, which is totally immoral. So one has to determine, taking into account all the elements involved. But one may have to use force as the ultimate resort. The armies were assembled on the battlefield, on the one side the wicked 100 and their supporters, and on the other side the 5 good people and their supporters. When the wicked man, the leader of the wicked group, saw the armies, he began to tremble. He began to tremble with fear. His force, his strength was much greater, militarily speaking. And yet there was this fear. This has been suggested as a rule of thumb method to determine which of our actions is sinful, unrighteous, wicked. That action, while doing which you are afraid, is undesirable. While doing something, if there is fear in your heart, it is more than likely that that action is unrighteous. We are not using it as a sort of general rule. It's a rough and ready rule, rough and ready principle, which one may be able to apply to one's life. I quite realize that it may not always work, it may not be always true, but this is one way of looking at it. That is, your own conscience, something deep within you says this is not right. And therefore this wicked man, though he had determined to fight when he came to the battlefield and saw that the battle was about to commence, he became afraid. Afraid? What did he do? He turned to his guru. Something strange again, which has intrigued me all the time. This person called Duryodhana, the leader of the wicked group, has been painted in the scripture as viciousness incarnate. And yet even he, when it comes to a vital decision, when he was standing at the crossroads, instinctively he thought of his guru. Not of his commander-in-chief, not of other people, but he thought of his guru. That means, in those days, even wicked people were ingrained with this devotion to the guru, devotion to the master. Incidentally, in those days, I think everywhere, not only in India, but all over the world, even robbers and dacoits first offered their prayer to God before going on their job. Yes, I think even here, everywhere, before going to murder somebody or kill somebody or rob somebody, a person went into a temple or a place of worship, offered a prayer there, please God, let my mission be successful, then went. So that in a certain way, those people seem to have been imbued with devotion. Right. Then he goes to the guru, not humbly, not in order to seek the guru's advice or instruction, but to instruct. This is the sign of a wicked man. He might go even to the guru. He might approach an elder, his father, his grandfather, whatever it is, whoever it is. But the moment he goes there, he doesn't want to discuss. He doesn't want to learn, but he wants to teach. He wants to instruct. It's an extraordinary thing. I don't think you have come across such wonderful instances here. As when you go to some of these ashrams, you will see that. Swami Maharaj, I am your humble disciple, but you must do this. I am your humble disciple, but you must do this. There is always somebody to instruct, counsel, advise, with all good intentions maybe. It's an extraordinary thing. You have noticed this in arguments, in discussions. Watch yourself next time you discuss with somebody else. How often you feel, I am right, he is wrong. It's interesting. Never mind who is right, who is wrong. We are not interested, we are not discussing all that. Just to be able to watch the mind. How often we are, it suggests to us, but I am right, she is wrong. And so I must tell her what is right. Full of love, I am not going to bully her. No. It's not as though I am saying that she is stupid. No. I am right. She is not able to see. Have you seen this within yourself? She is a very clever girl. She is not able to see this in this light. So I must tell her. It's beautiful. And the more wicked a person is, the more vehement he is, assertive. This is right, and therefore, this is not right. Somebody asked me, a wonderful priest, how can you not see it this way? If it is night here, it means it is not daytime. It's 8:30 now, in the evening, and therefore it is 8:30 p.m. and not 8:30 a.m., right? There's no two ways of looking at it. And he says, how is it that you can accept that, well, you know, for her it may be 8:30 a.m., for him it is 8:30 p.m., and for somebody else it may be something else. How is it, how can we accept that all of them are right? She says it is night, he says it is daytime, and she says it is midday. How can all of them be right? Probably, I don't know. The more vicious the person is, the more assertive he is. I am right and therefore you are wrong. It is not only I am right. Nobody is interested in this I am right business. If I am right, why must I assert it at all? Except to say you are wrong. Is it right? Huh? I am not interested in blowing my trumpet at all. That's perfectly all right. I can do it in my bathroom. This is a sign of immaturity if it is not downright viciousness. The more vicious a person is, the more assertive he is. So one must be watchful. Watch oneself. I wish you would do this just for the fun of it. I'm not saying that you must become moralist and so on and so on. That's up to you. But it's extremely interesting to watch in dialogue, in any conversation. Suddenly the old Adam jumps up and says, oh no, you are wrong, I am right. This is a sign of immaturity or wickedness. This Duryodhana goes to his guru. He says, hello, hi. Be careful. I go to a guru in order to learn, in order to ask for his advice. This fellow goes there and says, be careful, eh? And why be careful? This is another interesting thing in this, in the whole setup. Why be careful? He says, our army seems to be weak. His army is numerically stronger than the enemy. But yet he says, our army seems to be weak, inadequate, because probably you have, I hope you have not experienced this, probably you have at least heard of this. If a thief has come into your room, not robber, there's a big difference between a robber and a thief. A robber comes deliberately to steal, to rob you. He is not sneaking in. If a thief comes sneaking into your house and he is taking this away, you merely make some noise. You know what will happen? Out of sheer nervousness, he will drop this, he will break the glass, probably he will break his nose and start running away. He is much stronger than you are. Yet, because there is this conscience, this guilt, sense of guilt within him, he is weak. A person who is suffering from this sense of guilt is always weak. Always. We are only saying this. I am not saying if a man is vicious, he is weak. He may not be weak. A robber may not be weak at all. I might come into your house and rob, feeling quite right about it. Why should this girl have $1,000,000? It will happen. 3/4 of it belongs to me. She has no right to be a millionaire. Part of it belongs to me. There, I am not suffering from a sense of guilt. Yes, I am doing the right thing. It's not this we are referring to. We are referring to a situation where there is a sense of guilt. And when there is this sense of guilt, there is weakness. Then, on the other side, the good people. Here, the scripture has a tremendous lesson to teach us. Tremendous lesson. Probably you find that already there are contradictions or confusions, in any case, paradoxes, which are not so easy to understand. A moment ago, we said that self-assertiveness is a sign of wickedness, immaturity. We go on to examine the position of these good people. The hero of that side was Arjuna. Those of you who have read the Bhagavad Gita are familiar with this name. Arjuna was the hero. He takes a look at the armies on both sides and he starts shivering. Why does he shiver? Probably he suffered from a sense of guilt. We'll come to that a little later. But there is an unwillingness to do one's duty. You see that this is wrong, there is injustice there. But I am not so keen in doing anything about it. A young man is grabbing a young lady and robbing her. I am standing there watching. Either I am rationalizing or I am feeling, oh well, it's none of my business. Why? Because I feel weak. This is a remarkable lesson that this Bhagavad Gita teaches us, that to be weak is as stupid and bad, evil, as to be wicked. I want you to grasp this clearly. If someone walks in here and tries to choke her off, murder her, who is responsible? Who is guilty? Of course this man, murderer. But do you realize that we are also participants in this guilt? Because we were weak, because we were cowardly, all of us just turned our face and went away, just slipped out. Because that fellow was a ruffian, or he was armed to the teeth. All of us just sneak out. Oh, I don't know, maybe they had a quarrel, I don't know about it. And we just sneak out. Doesn't this happen in our life? Now comes the paradox, the dilemma. On the one hand, I am supposed to be not assertive. On the other, I am supposed to be not cowardly and run away. What am I supposed to do? Supposing somebody comes and demands, give me all your jewelry. Must I assert and kick him out? Is it my business? Or must I let him do what he likes and escape, slip away from this? Can I perhaps examine this situation a little more closely and see, are these the only two alternatives? asserting and escaping. Are these the only two alternatives that we have? Or do we have a third? Alternative. This is the whole theme of the Gita. If you are clever, if you are observant, if you are alert, and if you live your life carefully watching yourself wisely, then probably you will discover that we are placed in this sort of situation 1,000 times a day. That is why I feel this Gita is important to our life. We find ourselves 1,000 times a day in this situation. Someone does something, your brother, your sister, or your husband, or your wife, or somebody, which you do not approve of. What must you do? Must you say, "Hey, stop it"? Then you are asserting. Such assertion being a sign of immaturity and wickedness. All right. She is my daughter. Let her do what she likes. It's all right. Now, I am escaping. I am weak. Yeah? Now, what am I supposed to do? This is a paradoxical situation. You know what is meant by paradox? Literally? Huh? You know what the word paradox means? Literally. Dox means teaching. Paradox means beyond teaching. So, having suggested this, I am going to leave it there, because that is a paradox. That is not a thing which can be taught. We only say that this is not the wise approach to life. That is not the wise approach to life also. If your son or your daughter or your somebody is doing something funny, which you do not approve of, you shall not assert, "Shut up, don't do this." That is a sign of immaturity, wickedness, and it is not going to help the situation at all. Nor must you let this thing happen. "Well, she is my daughter, let her do what she likes." Then you are weak. You are also participant in the crime. What must I do? I leave it to you. Both these are not to be done. There is a paradoxical situation, something which is beyond teaching, and each one of us will have to find that. I may suggest that situation is love. Love does not assert, and love does not escape. But what love is, again, I have not explained. It is not possible. I can only say, if this young man is my son, and he is doing something which I don't approve of, I shall not assert my right over him. I shall not run away from my relationship. There is a third category, the third dimension. That dimension is love. I love him. He is my son. If I love him truly, I will neither assert my right over him nor escape my responsibility. This love will open out the right course of action. that's not saying anything at all, is it? Huh? That is not saying anything at all, because we are not, we cannot be governed by do's and don'ts. It's the most absurd thing to look for in life, do's and don'ts. People, all of them want, you know, they, since the days of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not, and thou shalt not, and thou shalt not, and thou shalt, and thou shalt not. Okay. We have been given the Ten Commandments in the Bible. We have been given the Ten Commandments in yoga. You know this, don't you? In Raja Yoga, there is this Yama and Niyama. Yama and Niyama are Ten Commandments. There are five Yamas and five Niyamas. We shall discuss it later. But immediately, I am given these Ten Commandments, what do I do? I was in Madagascar, and they are extremely pious Christians there, very good, very pious Christians, but heavy meat eaters. All of them eat meat. I was teaching them Raja Yoga, and there was this Yama, one of the disciplines. One of these was Ahimsa or non-injury. The same as thou shalt not kill. After the class, somebody asked a question. You said non-injury, Swami, but what about eating meat? I said, of course it's out. One doesn't eat meat at all. Why must you eat meat? You meet and eat. You meet other people and eat. You don't have to eat meat. And then I asked them, don't you believe in the Ten Commandments? They said yes. And in the Ten Commandments, aren't you told thou shalt not kill? Thou shalt not kill. You can't say, well, I am not killing, somebody else is killing. If you are eating meat, you are killing. Then they ran and brought a book, I don't know whether it was the Bible or something else, where the translation, the local into the local language, had been mutilated a little bit, thou shalt not kill a human being. Very beautifully. You know, it's just a, one has to translate. The verb in the English language, the verb kill is transitive verb. That means it needs an object. Yeah? I don't know if there are any English teachers here. Kill is a transitive verb. That is, it is, the sentence is incomplete if you do not supply an object. So they had provided the object. What was the object? Thou shalt not kill a human being. Even this is inadequate. You know why? What about war? Till that time, this country had not gone to war with another country. So they are quite safe. But supposing a few years later, this Madagascar enters a war against some other country, what will you do? Thou shalt not kill a human being, but since this fellow is my enemy, he is not a human being. It says, I will not kill a human being, but he is my enemy, I have to kill him. So, having discovered these Ten Commandments, we look for these Ten Commandments, we look for these do's and don'ts, and having got them, we are immediately going to mutilate them, twist them and turn them to suit our convenience. Why can we eat poultry and chicken and mutton and so on? Because these animals don't have a soul. A lovely way of rationalizing our own viciousness. This is what is going to happen. The moment I look for what they call guidelines for my conduct, I am going to try to discover ways and means of getting round inconvenient corners. So, in yoga, we are not given these guidelines. We are not given definite do's and don'ts. We are only told what we should not do. Thou shalt not assert yourself, and thou shalt not escape. Now, in your relationship, in your family relationship, in your relationship in society, you are watching yourself, and when it comes to self-assertiveness, you say, no, 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 that's not right. Ah, let's say Ali, it's all right. Let her do what she likes. No, no, that's also not all right. When I decide that this is not all right and that is not all right, then I become alert. This is very important. Probably, in the case of a yogi, there is no consistency of act behavior. This is a paradox. Again, we have seen in the case of our masters, there is no consistency, there was no consistency in their actions at all. A poor man goes to him and he gives him a lot of money. Beggars. And you know, when you give, you might find it when you go travel in India. When you find a beggar and you give him $1, he will go and brandish it in front of his friends. Look, 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 look what I got. And all the others run after you. This might happen. The master who gave him somebody a $2 bill might hound the next one coming along. Get out. What is this? He gave some money to the other man and with him, he is so rude. So it is. I can see one or two of you blooming. That is, you are trying to grasp this principle of no principle. There is a principle of no principle. I am not a dead human being, dead thing, mechanical thing. There is a tape recorder. You press it, press one switch, it will always record. You press another switch, it will always play back. You press a third switch, it will reverse. You press one switch, it will fast forward. I am not like that. I am a living thing, not a tape recorder. I am not a tape recorder. I am not a machine. So, I cannot be guided by these do's and don'ts. A reason why, I suppose I am right in saying this, the Ten Commandments were never obeyed. Am I right in saying that? If I have, what was this? There is a film called Ten Commandments, yes? I saw that. I saw that. It is said that Moses got so infuriated at what went on minutes afterwards. He gave them the Ten Commandments, went up or something like that, I have forgotten the story. And already they were mad. They were running amok. Is it possible for a human being to get into this straitjacket of thou shalt and thou shalt not? No. So why give them at all? Why try to find these Ten Commandments? And then spend all our life breaking them. Seems to be such a waste of time. So, in yoga, we are only told that don't do this and don't do that also. Don't do this and don't do its opposite also. In other words, be vigilant. Be vigilant, alert. Watch. Don't assert yourself. That is immaturity in wickedness. All right. Oh, no. Don't give up. There is a middle path, middle of the road path, which is neither this nor that. You've heard of either or. In yoga, it's neither nor. That is the difference. It is not either or. It is neither nor. Neither this nor that. Now you sit and discover what neither nor is. You've heard, probably some of you have read Somerset Maugham's The Razor's Edge. Have you? No. Some of you have read. This is what one of the source Indian scriptures says. Churasidhara Nishida Duratya Durgam Padastat Kavayo Vadanti Uttishtata Jagrata Prapyavaran Nibodata. Arise, awake, and go to these great ones and learn. Why must you do that? Churasidhara Nishida Duratya. The path to ultimate perfection, enlightenment or yoga or whatever it is, whatever you choose to call it, this path is like the razor's edge. Even some of the Swamis and some of us have misinterpreted this expression, this razor's edge, to mean that it is going to cut my foot. One has to walk on a razor's edge, you know, with great care. Otherwise, your foot may be cut. That's not the idea. That is probably not the idea at all. And a barber taught me this lesson. Not our master, no, nobody, but a barber taught me the lesson. You know, we shave our head about once a month with a proper razor. Not safety razor, a proper razor. And in our ashram in Rishikesh, there was a barber who has shaved only Swami's heads, a highly privileged person. You know why? Whereas everybody goes and bows to these holy men, the holy men bow to him. You have to bow down before a barber, otherwise he cuts you to pieces. So he had an extraordinary status. And having shaved the Swami's heads nearly every day, he had acquired an extraordinary talent, expertise. Sometimes I might be sitting and working in the stoop in the ashram, and he would come over and say, "Swamiji," and say, "I'm doing some work." He says, "Oh, never mind. I won't disturb your work." And he would sit next to me, put a cloth around my shoulders, and apply soap and do his job and go away. I might be typing or I might be doing anything. He's a fantastic man. I suppose if I was asleep and he did it, I wouldn't even wake up. He had such a expertise. One day, he was giving me the shave, and it was not as smooth as usual. Suddenly he stopped and asked me, "Does it hurt you?" I replied to him, "It is not as smooth as usual. It doesn't hurt, but it is not as smooth as usual." Then I wanted to find out, how did you know? I wanted to see if I winced or something like that, unconsciously. Then he held the razor in front of me. He said, "Can you see the edge?" I said, "Yes, it's like a thin piece of hair, dark hair. That's why." He said, "That's why." And then started doing sharpening it. Then he showed me again, can you see? I said, no. Now you see? Perfect. In other words, a razor's edge is invisible to the naked eye. A razor's edge is so sharp that it is invisible, not that it is going to cut your foot. So even so, this path of wisdom or the path of yoga is so sharp that you can't define it. You can't say, a yogi, oh, how can a yogi drink from a glass like this? No, that is, it's not your business. Can a yogi shout at him? Yes, of course, why not? He may. It's an unpredictable game. The yogi is an unpredictable being because he is watching himself all the time and he doesn't want to assert himself, he doesn't want to escape responsibility, he loves all, and in the light of this love, he sees the situation as it is, not as he wants to see. Not on the basis of these do's and don'ts. And his action becomes spontaneous. The yogi's actions are spontaneous. Not premeditated. Not preconceived. Not predetermined. That is the beauty of spontaneous behavior. And therefore, the spontaneous behavior can immediately somebody says, alright, supposing the Russians are coming up there and they are showering their bombs at you, what will you do? One can never suppose a situation and solve it now. That is not spontaneous behavior. Spontaneous behavior cannot be predetermined. If this happens, how will you do? What will you do? I don't know. I'll know it only at that moment. Let it happen. Supposing this gentleman suddenly gets up and points a dagger at me. What will you do? I don't know. He'll have to try. Maybe I keep quiet, all right, my time has come. Oh. Or maybe I hit him. Or take the dagger away from his hand, I may do anything. Or run away, jump out. So, in the case of a yogi, all these hypothetical situations and the reaction are absurd. You understand? It is because we are so anxious about solving hypothetical problems that we want these do's and don'ts. Isn't it? I want to have a set of rules because I want to know what this young man will do in a given situation. And having given him all these sets of do's and don'ts, I am waiting and watching to see how he gets out of those situations. And this play has been going on. There is no half measure here at all. One has to see that this middle path is something which cannot be seen at all. Since it cannot be seen, and I am supposed to walk that middle path, again a paradox. I cannot see the middle path, and yet I must walk this middle path. So what must I do? I must be alert, all the time, dead alert. Then, probably, I am able to see it step by step. As my foot comes down, I know where to place it. That's all I know. Where am I going to place the next foot? We will see when the time comes. What is most important here being this inner alertness. So this is the lesson that this little scripture called the Bhagavad Gita teaches us right in the beginning. Be alert, be watchful, because self-assertiveness is a sign of immaturity, wickedness, and blindly yielding weakness is also wickedness, undesirable. When you avoid these two, you get into a situation in which you are all the time alert and vigilant. That is yoga. I was told that some of you may have some questions to ask for a few minutes. Yes, sir.
Swamiji, sometimes I find myself in a situation where I have already initiated a chain of actions, and as soon as I have begun the chain of actions, I feel the fear in my heart, and I know that it is not going to lead to a good thing, and yet I feel powerless to terminate the chain. Many times I feel this is due to my own hardness of heart, but other times when I feel that it is almost as if I have to go ahead and go through the whole chain of actions, even almost
why must I, sir?
Will,
so why must I?
So that I can learn from it.
You have already learned. Will you do it, supposing you are standing on a precipice and looking down? Do you want to experience flying in the air and landing at the bottom? No. Why not? Because I see the danger in it. It is because you don't see the danger of continuing this chain
Is it feeling the fear but not seeing the danger?
Exactly, sir. Feeling the fear in a nebulous way.
Yes.
In a nebulous way, not clear again. Not clear again. It's only for instance, Radha has been telling me that Los Angeles is subject to frequent earthquakes. So when I go to bed, I feel, it's possible. It's possible that there may be an earthquake tonight. I'm not quite sure about it. I don't come face to face with the danger. I'm only suggesting to myself, because somebody XYZ has said that there is this danger here. It is a sort of hearsay danger.
Surely the fear of an earthquake is different from when one knows that one is...
Knows! Do you know, sir? Do you know? That's the point. No, I feel you don't.
When I feel, perhaps...
That's it.
About to bring something.
There is a tremendous difference between feeling this might happen and knowing this will happen. It is when, why must we talk in terms of riddles, sir? I'll give you an example. Having been brought up in South India, I've been used to drinking coffee. It's nothing, sir, unusual. I've even loved my cup of coffee. And recently, about 3 or 4 years ago, one after the other, somebody has been telling me, this coffee is no good for you, it will spoil your liver. Then I went to Italy. Somebody there said, oh, cappuccino, but it's not good for you. She's a very good woman, Mrs. Naim in Florence. She would give me and then say, no good for you. She couldn't speak English. Give it to me and say, no good for you, no good for health. And then there is another wonderful friend called Mrs. Pfeffer in Israel. She also used to say, don't drink coffee. I had a feeling that they were right. Was it of any use to me? No. I suppose I had, in your modern terminology, I had reduced the intake, you know, like smoking being reduced. One pack being reduced to half pack. Right? Then from there, I went to Belgium. Somebody came from Israel, and I don't know if you have been to Belgium, they serve coffee in a filter. First class, you know. Right in front of you, you see the bloody funny thing brewing. And oh, it's very nice. First class flavor. The speciality of Belgium. That must have been it. From there I went to France. One day I had a cup of coffee, just before I went to a meeting. I took half a cup. This half a cup of coffee wanted to bring all my lunch and everything out. I looked at it, quietly went somewhere, poured it out. That is called knowing. Knowing the danger.
Surely if a man knows.
Before, there was only a feeling of the possibility of a danger. This chain of actions, if you are, if you still feel that you are bound to it, obviously, a part of the mind is still suggesting that it is good. It may even suggest that I am going to learn a big lesson from it. What for? I don't want that lesson. Why must I stick my hand into the mouth of a tiger in order to learn how sharp the teeth are? I don't want to. I don't want to. So it's only when one does not see this very clearly, see the danger, to know the danger, that such arguments arise. Having initiated a chain of actions, am I bound to continue them? What for? What is the bondage? Must I, madam? What are the responsibilities?
Well, for instance, to a family.
That's not what we are talking about. There's no danger there.
No.
There's no danger there. Even there, if you feel that there is a danger, that it is leading to all sorts of confusions, one has a right to say, no, sorry, I stop here. Because pursuing a wrong course of action, even on the assumption that this is the chain reaction that one has initiated and so one is supposed to go on like that. What am I achieving? What am I doing? I am bringing more harm to you. Whereas, if I love my family, I would tell them, look, sorry, very sorry, I did something wrong. Let's stop it here so that more harm is not done. Isn't that more sensible? So this chain, even when you and I have initiated this chain, and it goes on, the moment you find that this is intolerable, you stop it. Now probably what you are talking about is, if he is married to somebody and he finds that a certain way of raising the family, etc., is undesirable. His wife doesn't agree. What does he do? That's all right. I mean, it's only 50%, isn't it? So the other 50% is still there. He may have to go on. He may have to. If he's not able to convince his wife that this line of conduct is undesirable. That's what you're talking. There is this sense of responsibility, duty, etc. But to say that since I have initiated this chain action, I must continue it even if I know that it is wrong. No. That may even demonstrate or prove lack of courage. Any other question? Yes, sir. Yes, madam.
It's a rather important question, but if I remember, you said that we may not or should not be guided by do's and don'ts. That we must become aware of a situation of thought or a philosophy of the neither nor, which will develop an inner alertness, which will guide our actions spontaneously, right?
Yes. Except that I didn't say that you should not be guided by do's and don'ts. We are not. It's
because it is not practical.
No, we are not. I don't know. I don't know about all that. I only know that we are not guided by do's and don'ts. Right. That's
well,
not serious.
It seems though that in order to act spontaneously, we need some frame of reference, some sort of ethical or moral climate which has been passed onto us. And this immediately presupposes that we will have the do's and don'ts in it. So within us, we have absorbed the do's and don'ts, and we act by them even on a subconscious level.
That is why there is this confusion, madam.
Pardon?
That is why there is this confusion in society today.
I agree.
Mm.
But you say that a human being then should act without any do's or don'ts, and is this practical? I mean, is this a... Let me think. I'm only saying that it is not possible because we have in us the do's and don'ts passed on to us by our culture, by our family, by our religion.
Most luckily for us, madam, that these do's and don'ts, though they have been passed on to us, are never used by us. luckily for us.
Thank you.
Now, what is the thing? What is the criterion that you and I are using now? I want you to look at it without prejudice. What is the criterion which guides our actions now as it is? Not these do's and don'ts. No, it's a multiple factor. The most predominant in this multiple factor being pleasure or yes, self or security. So I want this security. Security means pleasure. Pleasure means security for me. And then I begin to look around. These people have an idea that if I walk into a church with a girl and come out of the thing, this girl is going to look upon me as her husband and lord and master and so on. That seems to be very, very sensible. I am not interested in the marriage vows and so on. None of those do's and don'ts has any meaning for me. I am making use of these do's and don'ts in order to work out my security. Your daughter comes and tells you, "Mummy, you are my, I am your daughter. You must do this." Yes? And then you go on, yes, I am your mother, I am bound to look after you. That is do's and don'ts, it's come, the tradition has come from time immemorial. The mother looks after the daughter. Come age 15, come age 16, I may be late, mummy. I may be late, I may come tomorrow morning. What has happened now? She has found her security elsewhere. She needed you as a security for some time. And so she has told you all these do's and don'ts, all these traditions. The moment she has developed some affection elsewhere, the thing has changed. I am only giving you a crude example. So, are we really guided by these do's and don'ts? You will be perfectly right if you said that these do's and don'ts, when they are confronted by our own inner urges for pleasure, for security, for peace, we have these urges built into us. We want pleasure. We want security. And when these, what we might call natural urges, get confused with these traditions and the do's and don'ts, there is a lot of confusion in us.
But obviously an adult can discuss this on a more intellectual basis.
Thank you, madam. Why must I discuss it at all if there is this tradition and the do's and don'ts? There is no discussion.
Oh, well, because it's not practiced.
Ah, that's it. That is it. That's it. You have come back to what? No, you are right. That is, in the case of a child, I may come back to you with an inconvenient statement, please be careful. In the case of a child, it is always permissible to hand out do's and don'ts. And therefore, if you and I, being adults, still look for these do's and don'ts to be handed out to us by the priests or swamis or and so on, we are also children. Have you digested that? If you and I, being adults, are still looking for these do's and don'ts, we are immature and children. For a child, it is perfectly right. You are right. As a mother, you hand out a list of do's and don'ts to your children and then hope.
Would they be better to be guidelines rather than do's and don'ts?
No, madam. For children, it's difficult. In the case of little children, that's what she's talking. But in our case, it doesn't work, madam. That is where the conflict comes. Perfectly.
That later on, even subconsciously, they act.
Correct.
React according to these do's and don'ts.
I don't think so. Because at our adult stage, the what you call the subconscious conditioning of these do's and don'ts is there. But there is also the pressure of society, our own desires, all these things make such a mess of our life that we don't know what to do. We know what is right, we don't want to do it. We know what is wrong, we want to do it. So, it becomes a complicated business. That is why modern society, all us, the adult society, is so full of I want to say adultery. Adult society. Adultery not in the sense of any.
From this,
pardon, madam?
In adulthood, one can free
Exactly. Correct. And that is done by persistent vigilance. Only this vigilance is free from conditioning. What I call my natural urges, desire for pleasure, desire for companionship, etc., etc., even they may be conditioning. And these do's and don'ts may be conditioning. The only thing that is free from conditioning is this inner light, this vigilance.
Traditional teachings have any utility for adults, since adults do not use them as guidelines?
Sir, if we don't have these traditional teachings, you and I wouldn't be sitting and discussing them. And if you and I don't sit and discuss them here, we might be going to a nightclub, you know, spoiling our health. So in a way, I suppose they provide a sort of raw material. They provide a sort of base from which to leap.
Also to choose.
Pardon, madam?
Also to choose from.
Probably yes. But we have nothing to choose.
Make up your own mind what you want.
But no, I mean, we don't have to choose. You are right in a way that if you have all the different traditional dishes, and modern dishes and medieval dishes, you can choose from. I'm not quite sure, but yes, probably. Mm. We'll have a few minutes of meditation before. Okay, turn this off. And this practice of meditation, though we might do it only for a few minutes now, is also meant to train us in self-awareness, if such training is possible. And therefore, in order to turn the attention within first, we watch our breathing, then listen to the breathing. Those of you who have a mantra already will listen to the mantra within. When you are listening to the mantra, when you are watching your breath, you are already watching your mind. Then probably as you go on, if there is an intruding thought, you try to watch that thought. Try to discover the fountain source of that thought. Where does this thought have its origin? त्र्यंबकं निजामहे सुगंधिं पुष्टिवर्धनं उर्वारुकमिव वन्दनान् मृत्योर्मुक्षीयमामृतात् ॐ त्र्यंबकं निजामहे सुगंधिं पुष्टिवर्धनं उर्वारुकमिव वन्दनान् मृत्योर्मुक्षीयमामृतात् ॐ त्र्यंबकं निजामहे सुगंधिं पुष्टिवर्धनं ॐ सर्वेषां स्वस्ति भवतु सर्वेषां शान्तिर्भवतु सर्वेषां पूर्णं भवतु सर्वेषां मङ्गलं भवतु सर्वे भवन्तु सुखिनः सर्वे सन्तु निरामया सर्वे भद्राणि पश्यन्तु मा कश्चित् दुःखभाग् भवेत् असतो मा सद्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मा अमृतं गमय ॐ पूर्णमदः पूर्णमिदं पूर्णात् पूर्णमुदच्यते पूर्णस्य पूर्णमादाय पूर्णमेवावशिष्यते ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्ति